The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And when you listen to the nation of Iran, you can hear a lot of things. There are the voices of the old axis of evil chanting death to America.
Merg bar America!
Today could have been the end of hope on this issue. But now we are starting a new chapter of hope. And let's build on that. Let's consider this everybody's achievement.
Or you can listen for the voices of moderates, like Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, who claims he and others want to change Iran's relationship with the U.S. and the rest of the world. In the middle of this U.S. presidential campaign, though, which of the Americans should Iran be listening to?
This Iranian nuclear deal is catastrophic. It is the single greatest national security threat facing America.
Our president has signed a deal with Iran that guarantees that a radical Shia cleric will possess a nuclear weapon and a long-range rocket capable of reaching the United States.
Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran.
You know them by now, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and of course GOP frontrunner Donald Trump. Do they drown out President Obama, who signed the much maligned nuclear deal with Iran? Iran is in the midst of its own election season. Iranians head to the polls on Friday to vote for members of parliament and the Assembly of Experts, a powerful panel of clerics who will likely choose Iran's next supreme leader. One sign that they are looking backward, the fatwa declared for Muslims to murder author Salman Rushdie for his supposedly blasphemous book, The Satanic Verses. Over the weekend, the state-run media added $600,000 to the already ample bounty for Rushdie's murder. Marco Werman, host of PRI's The World, and reporter Matthew Bell are just back from Iran, and they join me now. Welcome, Marco and Matthew. And which Iran did you find on this trip?
Really, we were only in Tehran. We submitted a visa request just for stories in Tehran and a very specific group of stories. We looked at young people specifically, young people who had been away from Iran and had come back and are doing startup businesses. We met filmmakers. We met musicians. We went to the top of Mount Tochal, which is just outside of Tehran, just on the north side of the city. And we met skiers who go up there on Friday. You know, usually Friday is for Friday prayers in Islam. They, a lot of people in Tehran, surprisingly, do not pray, and found a lot of them up on the top of the mountain on the slopes.
There's a tech community that you discovered. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about it, and we're going to hear from one of the entrepreneurs that you spoke with.
So we met first a woman named Nazanin Daneshvar, who's started a kind of a Groupon and a slash delivery service called Takfifan. She's rare in that she's a woman in this business, but she doesn't think that makes her especially special. But a couple of years ago, she had one idea for a startup. Noticing her parents were struggling with groceries, she launched this online delivery service. Started up slowly, and then local media in Tehran did a little article on it, and the thing just exploded. She had 5,000 orders in a day. She had one delivery person. She couldn't handle it. She shut it down, retooled, and went away to Germany, came back, and started this new business, which is kind of Groupon, and now it's also providing kind of a platform to sell stuff as well on the retail market.
And it's the intensity of the business that really matters more than religious issues on the work side, as we can hear.
For example, if you would have come like an hour ago, we had a head of a company that knows that the founder is a female in here. So they all came super religious, and they were not even looking at me while they were talking over the deal. You know, so this is quite normal. So I always take one of our male managers, and he always talks on our behalf, but that way I keep on fixing stuff.
Are they working around the traditionalism in Iran as you saw it?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways they are, you know, and they were surprising just to sit down and talk with about it's to see how similar this was to talk with startup folks, you know, in a place like Boston or Austin, Texas. One thing we asked Nazanin was, what do you say, because she studied abroad, we said, what do you tell other Iranian expats who are interested in maybe coming back to Iran to build a career? And she said, I don't hesitate. I absolutely tell them to come back. In fact, she says, I tell them they have to come back. You know, the country depends on them, and that the older generation is not going to change the country, that it's up to younger people.
And we've talked with many, many artists who are expat artists who left Iran to come to the United States or in Europe. But you found that that's no longer an issue anymore, at least in the same way. You found a lively pop and music community there as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a few years ago, I presented a band at South by Southwest in a little showcase I was producing called All Music is World Music. And we had 127 Band from Tehran. It was the first band from Iran to play at South by Southwest. And they were working in this very kind of slightly sketchy underground scene where they were rehearsing in these industrial kind of warehouses that were decrepit and in disrepair, or in a greenhouse on the outskirts of Tehran where nobody would find them. But what we found were a couple of bands that are kind of working within the confines and restrictions of the Ministry of Culture, and they are submitting their work and they are getting the green light to perform it. So they're pushing the limits, they're going straight up to the line, and they're saying things that I found kind of surprising. We heard a band called Pallet on our last night there, and they were basically playing klezmer music from the Balkans, and the entire auditorium was clapping along. I said, am I not getting something here? You guys are approved by the Ministry of Culture. You're playing klezmer music, which I associate with Jewish culture. And he said, hey, hang on a second. You're leaving out about 95% of the other world that plays klezmer music. So, you know, they're pushing up to the lines or even going beyond it.
And here's a band that's rock, southern Iranian style here. This is the leader of the band, Damahi.
You know, Ministry of Guidance in Iran, they really support us to do this project and to make this project happen.
Did they explain why they wanted to support you, why they like you?
I think because we are working on a culture that it might be forgotten for some years ahead, you know?
And that's a far cry from the days of Ayatollah Khomeini back in 1979, when all music tapes were banned and music of any kind was banned.
Absolutely, yeah. You wouldn't see this kind of stuff on the stage. I mean, and the crowd was totally hip. You know, it could have been a crowd in Boston or New York. And then we get to the front to give our tickets in, and there's like a row of six or eight guys standing there who look like they're, you know, straight from Hamas, or, you know, from the Ayatollah's political party. And I'm like, wait, oh, right, you know, this is Iran, and it's not...
We're in Tehran.
Yeah, it's not, it is not New York City.
Just back from a week in a very, very different Iran, and Iran in the midst of change and really rethinking its relationships with the United States as well as the rest of the world, as we do the same here in this very raucous political campaign where Iran is very much a subject. Marco Werman, host of PRI's The World, and Matthew Bell, reporter with PRI's The World. Before we go, gentlemen, any thoughts about Donald Trump on the streets of Tehran?
Great question.
Donald Trump, yeah. I mean, one thing, it's a trip to see, you know, statements from Donald Trump and Ted Cruz on the front page of a newspaper like one that's called Kayhan, which is the longtime supporter of the regime, you know, and they would grab things like Ted Cruz saying that he'll rip up the nuclear deal. And there it is on the front page. And it's just sort of, you know, highlighting some of the wackier aspects of American politics. And Donald Trump came up. Several people brought up, what is going on with Donald Trump? And
is he a legitimate candidate?
Yeah, it just unprompted, you know, frankly. And we would say, well, wow, he sure is entertaining, isn't he? But he's probably not going to get elected. And three different people said, yeah, that's what we said about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad the hardline president that got elected in 2005. And especially in Tehran, too. You know, people, it's just a very cosmopolitan place. I haven't been to other parts of Iran, but just suspect that it's very different from the kind of conservative heartland where the regime supporters, many of the regime supporters come from.
Well, I can hear that you felt quite at home there in Tehran.
Ready to go back tomorrow, John.
Matthew Bell and Marco Werman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Marco Werman, host of PRI's The World and reporter with The World, Matthew Bell, both visited Iran and have just returned. The innovators and inventors in our series that have brought their ideas to market have all shared that there is something they all have in common, a headwind of doubt and skepticism, and even the difficulty of immigrants finding their way in a new country that all push them to seek out new ideas and embrace innovations. Certainly the headwind for African Americans seeking technological solutions could not have been greater, working at the height of the Jim Crow segregation era in the South and rampant racism in the North. Keith Holmes is the author of Black Inventors, Crafting 200 Years of Success, a book that includes innovator Garrett A. Morgan, the son of slaves. Garrett's granddaughter, Sandra Morgan, says that didn't stop him from trying to solve the problems facing his community and beyond.
My grandfather was a man of a lot of ideas and a lot of ambition. And so, as he was growing up, he always thought that he'd like to work with his head, not his hands. And he was a bold fellow that gave it a try.
Was the expectations at the time for people like your grandfather, African Americans, a boon or an inspiration for him to be bolder than he might have otherwise been?
Well, I think that it was bigger than being African American or looking to African American innovation or invention. You know, at the time, my grandfather was born in Kentucky. He was living in Kentucky and then later in Cincinnati. And he was really drawn to Cleveland or to Northeast Ohio because there was such a significant amount of business going on here and innovation. Remember, this is the time of Edison. This is the time of, you know, the railroads greatly expanding automotive industry. And he simply wanted to be a part of the buzz.
Keith, how did the characters that you've written about reflect that sense of, here I can do anything?
You know, it's the same thing that Sandra was saying, that the creative opportunities, the fact that they didn't let race become a factor in terms of their creativity. And with the explosion of the economy at that time, people saw an opportunity where if they came up with an idea, they had an opportunity to get some economic rewards from that.
You know, most Americans who don't know much about their history could give you a list of innovators in America, and it would probably be Thomas Edison and Steve Jobs. People just don't know the broad culture of innovators. Give us some names of people and stories that, to you, typify the 200 years of success that you write about in your book.
Well, we got to talk about Elijah McCoy, who came up with the automatic lubricator. You know, could you imagine riding on a train or a bus and the operator tells you, well, hold up 1 minute, we have to stop this train or bus, and someone has to get out with a little oil can and oil all the different parts. Well, the invention that Elijah McCoy came up with eliminated that.
Let's talk about McCoy for a second,
okay.
Because his brilliant idea was people thought of the machine as there was the pumping of the fuel that turned the gears and all of that, mm-hmm. and that the oil was something different. McCoy said, why can't it all be the same?
Exactly.
Why can't you have an oil pump just like you have a fuel pump, and why can't the oil just sort of integrate itself with the metal? And that's really conceptually exactly what innovation is about.
And it's interesting you brought that point up, because now we're talking about cars, we're talking about trains, we're talking about boats. All of these require some form of automatic lubrication, as well as the machineries that were being run at that time.
Which brings us to Garrett Morgan. Now, he developed a lot of things, but why don't you start the list of inventions that your grandfather was responsible for, Sandra?
Well, my grandfather held 5 patents total. One is the Garrett Morgan safety hood, which serves as the precursor to the modern-day gas mask. And what it incorporated was a carbon pack that allowed individuals to spend way more time in toxic environments because they were able to filter the air. The other most notable patent that you would probably recognize is the traffic signal. There were a number of traffic signals on the market. Most of them just said stop and go, which was problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, there was no protocol for the intersection. And number two, there were a number of people who at that time could not read. Part of his inspiration was there were so many different types of vehicles and individuals on the road at the time. And my grandfather, along with my father and my Uncle John, witnessed a horrific accident that my father talked about until the very end, until he passed away. And so it obviously had a significant impact on him as a child to see an automobile hit a horse-drawn carriage, which resulted in grave injuries to a little girl, and as well the horse had to be put down right at the scene. It was pretty terrifying for him, and it was something that really drove my grandfather to do something about it.
Instead of tolerating those kinds of mistakes and industrial errors, innovators see it as a problem to be solved, and they solve the problem. What do you think the situation is like today in terms of invention and innovation? Is it an egalitarian system in the United States? Is it anybody who has a great idea gets ahead?
In all honesty, I think that it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, innovation has never been greater because there's so many outlets and so many opportunities. The other side of that is that I think that a lot of innovation has taken place within corporate sectors and within other business sectors. And so it's, I think, more difficult for independent inventors like my grandfather to invent, and if they come up with an idea, to bring that idea to the market.
Keith, final thoughts on that?
She's absolutely correct. I mean, in 2013, Japan alone had filed for 700,000 patents and inventions. In the United States, it's 500,000. But I think the opportunity is here more now than ever before, because when you have a situation such as the economy and or war going on, that's the time for the greatest growth when it comes to technology. People are looking for a way to improve, or they're looking to increase their income. So the opportunity here now is the best time for innovation, particularly here in the United States.
Keith Holmes is the author of Black Inventors, Crafting Over 200 Years of Success. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
And Sandra Morgan is granddaughter of the inventor Garrett A. Morgan. Thanks so much, Sandra.
Thank you.
Later this hour, a conservative Tea Party activist formulates a vision of environmentalism in the heart of the Sun Belt, or should we say the Solar Belt. When did a persuasive message turn you around on an issue? Grand Prairie, Texas. I always believed I was pro-prevention, pro-choice, until I experienced an abortion. It's not that clear-cut, and it made me more considerate and aware of educational and healthcare issues.
My name is Angie Kiblinger. I'm calling from Hillsboro, Oregon. In high school, a friend gave a speech expressing his views on the death penalty, and his arguments were so convincing it made me change my mind. I've been opposed ever since.
Tell us your story of changing your mind. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The sounds of protests outside Delhi have left 19 dead and affected the area's highway and water system to millions of people. When Indian leader Narendra Modi took power in 2014, his principal difficulties were seen to be overcoming his association with sectarian violence in the places in India where his political career began. But the challenges he's facing today are more a consequence of the structural weaknesses and unsustainability of India's economic system. These protesters belong to the Jat caste, a group mostly consisting of farmers who are demanding official status as backwards class, which would make them eligible for government jobs and educational quotas. From Delhi, joining us is Sanjoy Majumdar, Indian correspondent for the BBC News. Sanjoy, welcome.
Hi there.
So what is the scale of these protests, and what does it say to the government's ability to keep things in balance right now?
Well, the scale was quite large, and the strategy very much by the protesters were to basically cut off links between Delhi and the rest of India. And they were able to do that by blocking the highways leading into the city, disrupting train services leading into the city, which meant that the only way out to most places was to fly. And that, of course, is not possible for everyone. The other thing, of course, that took place was a tremendous amount of violence spread across many small towns. Government property was damaged, vandalized. And then, of course, there was that attack you referred to, or the consequence of which you referred to, which is Delhi's water supply being affected. That because a vital source of Delhi's water, a canal which supplies almost three quarters of Delhi's water supply, was damaged by the protesters.
There is no water. And this is the fourth day morning, we are having no water.
4 days with no water. And how many people in your family?
Myself, my two sons, my daughter-in-law, my grandson. He's only 5 months old.
A citizen of Delhi who's speaking for many in the continued water shortages in the wake of these protests. What political attempts have been made to deal with the grievances of this caste? And how many other grievances are there up and down the caste system in India right now?
Well, that's really getting to the heart of the situation. The government at the moment has basically reached out to these protesters by saying that they're willing to look into their demands and appear to be giving them a very sympathetic hearing. Now, basically what these groups, the community which calls themselves Jats, what they're demanding is to be included among a group of low castes who benefit from an affirmative action quota. These were basically created to try and improve the lot of communities in the caste system who have been traditionally or historically disadvantaged socially, discriminated against for centuries. And it was an attempt to give them a level playing field by guaranteeing a percentage of university places and government jobs for them. Now, the Jats are traditionally a relatively affluent community, a landowning community. Most of them have historically been farmers. And so they're also considered higher caste. But over the years, effectively, what's happened is with land shrinking or not available for agriculture, they've been left looking at the government as a source of employment and therefore want also to be given affirmative action caste quotas so that they can also be guaranteed jobs.
How many other castes would have similar grievances or grievances of any kind, which they would take to the streets in sympathy or at least to repeat this pattern of unrest?
That's something that's really of concern to the government and also to many other people who are basically saying that if you're seen to give in to the political demands of one community, what's to prevent other communities from coming forward with similar demands, citing similar economic deprivations?
A political crisis that conceivably threatens the entire economic model in India. Sanjoy Majumdar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sanjoy Majumdar is India correspondent for BBC News. In differentiating the remaining candidates in the GOP field, one issue stands out. It has nothing to do with personality, bad hair, religious piety, or bank accounts. It's all about the sun. According to a Clear Path poll conducted at the end of last year, 72% of Republicans think we should take action to accelerate the development and use of clean energy technology in the United States. 56% of Republicans believe climate change is real and at least in part connected to human behavior. But it remains an issue the GOP typically steers clear of. In Nevada, this issue has hit the pocketbooks of solar contractors and consumers, though, who use solar panels. State regulators, backed by the state's electric utility, NV Energy, rolled back an important financial incentive for rooftop solar owners. Debbie Dooley has seized upon this contradiction and is twisting the knife for conservatives to see the issue her way. Dooley is president of Conservatives for Energy Freedom.
I support all clean energy. I think it's more fiscally responsible to prevent damage to the environment than it is to try to clean it up. But I'm not anti-coal or anti-fossil fuel. I'm pro-consumer and believe energy, as I said, it's more we should promote innovation. Our nation has always promoted innovation, not stagnation.
Why is climate change a non-starter for so many of the folks in the Tea Party and in the conservative movement, But when you frame it as an energy independence and, you know, almost a libertarian argument, it's a completely different kind of thing.
But because it's all about the message. A lot of conservatives for years, for example, in Georgia, when I began to advocate for solar at the beginning of 2013, I was the first conservative in the state that actually began to strongly advocate for solar. A lot of times, a lot of the narratives that conservatives and Republicans have heard are coming from groups that are connected with fossil fuel interest. And they're like, I don't know if you recall in Russia, I believe it was in the 50s, there was a scientist named Ivan Pavlov that conditioned his dogs. The dogs, when you hear a certain word or a bell or whistle, you react. And conservatives have been conditioned that when you hear solar, you think, oh, that's bad. It's only for liberals or tree huggers. And it's related to climate change.
So conservatives have been conditioned like Pavlov's dogs, in your view.
Yes.
Yeah.
That they actually have. I mean, that's something I actually believe. When you hear solar, they've been conditioned to react a certain way. Republicans, I have seen poll after poll that show with the right message, conservatives, even Tea Party conservatives, by like a two-thirds margin, support solar. But if you bring in climate change into the mix, that will go down. Ronald Reagan said that being good stewards of our environment should not be a partisan issue. And I think it is extremely unfortunate that special interests have made this a partisan issue, and it should not be. And I'm working to change that.
There's a lot of solar lobbyists on K Street and solar financial interests that, you know, are working to advance their cause. Are you in the pocket of the solar industry? Do you have solar investments?
No, that would be ridiculous, but I receive funding from a variety of different people in different groups. It's not just one, and my funding is below a shoestring budget. So to think I'm in the pocket of anyone is totally and completely ridiculous.
The Wall Street Journal says that there are solar subsidies that end up going to big banks, even though they're intended to benefit low-income consumers, and that the whole incentive structure in Nevada is a bit of a scam on its face.
Well, the biggest incentive and subsidy that's out there is the monopolies. They're subsidized by captive ratepayers, utility customers. Fossil fuel has been very heavily subsidized since 1932, and fossil fuel is still being heavily subsidized. Nuclear, the same way. The first 15 years of nuclear, the federal subsidies accounted for 1% of the federal budget. The first 15 years of solar, you're not even looking at 1/10 of 1% of the federal government. I don't believe in the government picking winners and losers. So some of the same people I see criticizing solar subsidies are being very hypocritical, because they're not saying one thing about the massive subsidies that monopolies receive and fossil fuel interests receive.
Debbie, do you think this is going to be a major issue in the national campaign on the conservative side as we get between here and the convention?
Oh, I think it absolutely will be. And I think the Republican candidate that can begin the message of let's remove the barriers, let's advocate for energy freedom and clean energy. They don't have to mention climate change as long as they're advocating for energy freedom and energy choice, and let's remove the barriers and not let monopolies stand in the way.
Debbie, do you have your own personal investments in solar companies, any pension investments, that sort of thing?
Well, I don't, and it's because I don't have money to invest. I gave up a good paying job for some time, for about a year and a half. I mean, it cost me to advocate on behalf of energy freedom and solar. So I went through any money I had, you know, so I could actually live. So I went through my savings. I have no investments. I don't have money to invest. But if I did, I would invest in solar because I think that is the future, is solar.
Debbie Dooley is the president of Conservatives for Energy Freedom. Today's coverage of climate change is a collaboration with WBEZ's Heat of the Moment project. Find out more at heatofthemoment.org. Chris Mosier is a champion. His sport is the biking and running sprint duathlon, and he will compete at the World Championships in Spain this June after becoming the first transgender man to qualify for a men's U.S. national team. Chris identifies as an athlete and he competes as a man, although that was not always the case as he was growing up. Policies for transgender athletes are inconsistent. Under previous International Olympic Committee guidelines, trans athletes were required to undergo reassignment surgery to be eligible to compete. Mosier says transitioning from a woman to a man confers no physical advantage.
I think that no trans person is going to transition to excel in sports. That's just not a reality that we're facing now. And so I think it's ridiculous to think that someone would go through the process of changing gender for Olympic gold.
Mosier's activism helped convince the IOC to remove its surgical requirement, and the International Triathlon Union, which oversees the world championship in that sport, followed their lead, opening the door for Mosier to compete and for other trans athletes to potentially compete at the Olympic level. Mosier is founder of transathlete.com, and when not training, he mentors trans athletes around the world through the program GoAthletes.org to help them better deal with some of the obstacles they may be facing.
Well, trans folks are dealing with not only being able to compete in their sport, so physically and ability-wise, but there are a lot of external factors that play into a trans person's performance. For me personally, it was, how will my teammates accept me? How will I be able to participate? What will it be like in the locker rooms? What will it be like in my uniform? Because a lot of sports organizations and leagues don't have trans-inclusive policies.
How did you overcome those obstacles?
The only way out is through. Mm. And so for me, it was really, I didn't have any role models to look to or anyone who had done this before that I knew of. So I personally knew of no trans men who were still competing in sports after a medical transition. And so for me, it was really going through the process of figuring out where I felt comfortable in the locker room, figuring out how to navigate pool spaces as a trans person. It was exploring the policies and talking to the people in charge of leagues and organizations, and if they didn't have a policy, asking why and asking if they could change their policies. I think that as we have more people in my position who are able to push policies forward and push leagues forward and further the understanding of what it's like to be a transgender person in sports, I think we'll see that those areas are changing and it should be better for folks who follow after.
What was it like for you to go down this road and decide at each level you were going to reach higher?
I spent about a year of thinking about whether or not I would transition based on my competitiveness in sports.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing well in athletics in the female category, but I didn't feel comfortable telling people that I was winning races because it was the women's category. You know, it was more my perception of myself in that I didn't feel like I was a woman. I also didn't feel like I was a man. And so I felt like I was somewhere in between, and I just didn't fit in that women's category. But I didn't know what it would be like to transition in sports and to start competing as male. And people kind of told me that I would not be competitive, that I would transition and I would move from someone who was placing in my age group in the women's category to being a sort of middle of the pack guy. I think that that was very motivating for me to think that I then had to overcome these sort of perceptions of what I would be capable to do.
Is that part of the gender mythology that goes along with sports, that the capabilities are clearly unequal and that there's sort of no way around that?
Absolutely. It's a totally sexist thing that our society does in thinking of who's a good athlete and who's not and who will be capable of performing. And we know that there are very fast women and there are very strong women and there are women who could beat men in many different sports.
What regulations did you need to challenge to even get to the world championship level?
So the old International Olympic Committee policy on trans inclusion included a clause that said that there needed to be a full surgical transition, and it was extremely prohibitive for trans athletes, and that was the sort of basis of my challenge.
So how did you get them to change their mind?
I think it was a long time coming, but I think that it really took having an athlete push and say, am I going to be included? Here's my situation. I think they really just needed a name and a face and someone to actually be in a position to contest it.
And do athletics force for you to medicalize your transition, or can you be free about how you want to transition and still be an athlete at this level?
It really depends on the trans person. And so there's not just one way to be transgender. Some people choose to do a medical transition, which means using hormones, and some people do not. With the new regulations in the IOC, trans men can compete on either team. That would be a person assigned female at birth who identifies as male. If they're not taking hormones, they can compete with men, or they can still compete with women. For me, having taken testosterone, it has really medicalized my, my experience. I need to give a lot of doctor's reports in order to be able to participate because I take testosterone, which is a performance-enhancing substance.
In athletics, what do you think the greater difficulty is going from female to male or male to female?
Social acceptance is transgender women always face more discrimination. Really, when I transitioned, people were like, oh, okay, whatever. No one thought that I would be competitive. But anytime a transgender woman comes up as an athlete who's performing well, they are always, always discriminated against.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's just a general lack of understanding of trans identities. But in terms of the people who this is important to, I think there's a huge impact. I think the opportunity now is there for younger folks, for young trans people, to look at me and see that it is possible to be your authentic self and continue to play the sports that you love.
Do you think someone not having the same strength of character and sense of mission about their gender identity, how much more difficult would this path be for them compared to you?
It would be very difficult to continue in sports if I didn't have that sort of sense of self. Not everyone is in a position where it's safe for them to be out in the way that I'm out. So if you're thinking about recreation after, post-college, college has its own regulations in both recreation and NCAA participation. K through 12, there are a variety of policies that are either very good or very, very bad. There are bills up right now that would completely restrict trans students from participating in athletics. My hope is that with the IOC change, that this will have the trickle-down effect. People look to the Olympics for the gold standard. And so I think that there will be recreation leagues, there will be state organizations, high school organizations that are looking to this policy and saying, oh, hey, we need to make a change to what we have in place already.
Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Mosier is the first transgender man to make the men's U.S. national team in the duathlon. He's the founder of transathlete.com.
Whoa, if I could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee.
Here's something to take with you. A Florida lover of nature showed more love of himself in an outrageous video that shows him pulling a small shark from the ocean, pinning it on the beach while he posed bravely with his beleaguered and immobilized shark. It makes you want the little shark to grab this brave adventurer's little man bun and drag him back into the ocean. The man eventually returns the disoriented shark to the water after about a minute, where it remains stuck in shallow water for a time, possibly hoping to grow up and get more of a taste of tender tourist garnished with tie-dyed cotton swim trunks. Can always dream. Future episode of Shark Week? Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The amazing repartee. If I could walk with the animals and talk with the animals, grunt, squeak, and squawk with the animals, and Lord, they could talk to me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.